What do fascists do when they see strange images and bright colors and discover confusing feelings within themselves? They call the degenerate art police. Hey everybody, I'm Matthew Remsky. That was an anti-fascist dad joke. Welcome to episode 12. More degenerate art, please, with Sarah Jaffery.
But in the age of Trump, I think transgressive art is empathetic. It's transgressive to be empathetic now. To get people to see through your eyes, to experience the world through your individual voice, to slow people down, to get them to think. They don't always do that, but to make them pause. And I think it's really important for us to remember that art takes time, and the more they speed up our time to look at art, the more they're trying for us to not critically think.
But first,
it's like, I don't know how you can go out and protest the structure of the entire economic system if you can't keep your room organized.
Yes, housekeeping. So you can find me on Blue Sky and Instagram under my name, and on YouTube as Anti-Fascist Dad. I'm also on TikTok under that same handle, and I try to post, you know, 3 to 4 mini essays a week there. My Patreon is at Anti-Fascist Dad Podcast, where subscribers get early access to every part 2 of these main feed episodes, as well as some other pieces of content. And lastly, in the show notes, you'll see a pre-order link for the book that this podcast is based on and supporting, Anti-Fascist Dad, Urgent Conversations with Young People in Chaotic Times. The publication date is coming up soon, April 26th, 2026, this very year. Happy New Year, by the way. In fascist squish and anti-fascist news of the week, in keeping with the theme today with Sarah Jaffery, I'll briefly ping the anti-fascist photography intervention of Christopher Anderson in his recent Vanity Fair collection of portraits of White House figures. If you haven't seen them, I'll link to them in the show notes. They're incredible. And what's so powerful about Anderson's series is that he can describe himself as a professional noticer, as you'll see in the accompanying text, not as an anti-fascist, and he doesn't have to use any terminology. He doesn't have to engage in any debate. He can simply visually frame Trump's cabinet members for who they are: anxious, alienated, isolated, awkward. J.D. Vance is backed up against a wall, slightly off-center. Susie Wiles is standing next to what seems to be an infinite regress of darkened rooms, where a ghost is floating in the furthest room in the back. The image that parallels comments she made in the interview that she thought, for some reason, would be off-record, allude to how Trump reminded her of her alcoholic family. And she looks stunned and terrified as she gazes into Anderson's lens. And then there's Marco Rubio. At first, he looked to me like he was standing like a kind of depressed Christopher Robin looking down at Pooh, although Pooh is a table lamp glowing orange like his boss. But then there's also this hint that he's about to collapse forward in a kind of fentanyl fold. Carolyn Leavitt is desperately trying to strike a power pose in her full figure portrait, but Anderson gets in nauseatingly close for a facial shot that shows that her makeup people don't really respect her enough to cover the filler injection marks on her lips. But I also got to give bonus points here for Anderson showing another approach to gender performance. There's so much to say about the misogyny of Trump's world, especially during this wave of Epstein revelations. And feminist writers and content creators have been doing a lot of great work on the so-called Mar-a-Lago look that women in the Trump sphere seem to uniformly adopt as they get closer to the center of power, from Kristi Noem to Kimberly Guilfoyle to Erica Kirk. But Anderson seems to degender all of his subjects with these relentlessly close and granular shots that strip out all of the puffed up or hair-flipping performativity that characterize the gender essentialist scene. And I think he really helps to clarify that gender itself is an abstraction, something that the photographer has to buy into and agree to spotlight, and he just doesn't. There's nothing powerful or vital about any of these people in these sterile scenes, and I think that's because he's taken away their weaponization of gender. Stephen Miller is shot in shadows that hollow out his cheeks and make him look like the reincarnation of Joseph Goebbels. But behind him in one of the photographs is an 1870s painting called Indian Encampment on the Platte River, and it's by a painter named Thomas Worthington Wittridge, and it depicts Native Americans on horseback crossing the Platte River and returning toward their teepee village. Now, the painting was notable for its time because of its portrayal of indigenous communities as calm, non-threatening, in harmony with nature. These are just people doing their thing. They're not aggressive. They're not antagonistic. They're not a threat to anybody. So Anderson is putting the racist deportation czar, Stephen Miller, in front of that. Now, I think it's safe to say that Anderson won't be invited back to the White House after this, but the fact that he was able to get as close as he did is a real tribute to how photography, unlike journalism, I think, can really be a black box to the elite. At one point, a somewhat vulnerable Stephen Miller remarks to Anderson, "You know, you have a lot of power in the discretion you use to be kind to people." And Anderson replies, "Yeah, you know, you do too." And so what's perfect about this as a guerrilla attack is that, as my guest will point out, image control is everything to fascists because they can feel how fragile and brittle things are in their unseen worlds. Sarah Jaffrey is an art historian, an educator, a curator, and writer who focuses on modern art. And she particularly focuses on philosophy, politics, and artistic process. She currently heads up the art history program at City Lit and previously worked as lead educator for the Bridget Riley Art Foundation in the Department of Prints and Drawings at the British Museum. She's also worked at Wellcome Collection, exploring the connections of art, medicine, and human experience. Her art history scholarship really focused on the links between poetry and painting in late 19th century France. And then her cultural studies work has focused on the use of Instagram in anti-capitalist protest. Here's our conversation. Hello, Sarah. Welcome to Anti-Fascist Dad.
Hi, Matthew. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You've got a lot of art history on board that we're going to get to, but I want to start with some very urgent questions for younger people who make or who love art. So first of all, what at this point makes art politically impactful or transgressive in the era of Trump?
Well, I often say to my students that all art is political. It doesn't matter what time period it's made in, for a few reasons. Number one, artists are able to make what is invisible visible. And that's a very powerful thing to be able to do. And when you have that power, it can be wielded usually by very powerful patrons. And it has been. But from the 19th century forward, artists had less and less patronage. And so their art became their sort of direct political voice. And that's kind of where we are today. But in the age of Trump, I think transgressive art is empathetic. It's transgressive to be empathetic now, to get people to see through your eyes, to experience the world through your individual voice. To slow people down, to get them to think. They don't always do that, but to make them pause. And I think it's really important for us to remember that art takes time, and the more they speed up our time to look at art, the more they're trying for us to not critically think. So I think transgression here is empathy. And the last thing I'll say is that I often talk about the artist as a witness. Art is witness testimony of what it felt like to live in a particular place in time. And that is often why it gets censored. You know, it's biased. I always say, oh, it's biased and it's not objective. Well, nothing's ever purely objective. It's valuable to hear an individual's point of view. And that's also what makes it transgressive as well. It encourages empathy, and it's the artist recording what it's like to live in time and place. And that can be like a minute, tiny little experience, and that's still valuable. It doesn't have to be some grand, like, huge political statement about a particular party, but it can be about you in that specific place and time. And I don't think we give enough attention to those small things. So that's can make it very transgressive in our time and place.
So connecting two of those things together, you started by saying artists make the invisible visible. And then you said art in the era of Trump that's transgressive is empathy. Ergo, I think what you're saying is that it's actually pretty hard to see empathy at this particular point in history.
It is. I mean, in everything, and you know, my personal opinion, but many people I've spoken to, is it's hard to see empathy. Or empathy is a muscle that you have to flex and you have to practice. And when you just glance at a work of art, you take a photograph of it. I'm not demeaning people for doing that, because that's kind of what we're encouraged to do.
Right.
It does not give you that time to have a conversation and to get inside that artwork. So it's this kind of, how does an artist do that? And also, I really want to stress that artists are not required to make things that we want. They need to express what's in themselves. And it's the viewer that needs to take the time to do it, but we're never given the time. So when I was thinking about today, I was thinking a lot about time, you know, the time that we're not given to explore empathy. And so, yeah, artists are always visualizing empathy for us. You know, it's what it's like to be in their skin. And that might be that in the past they worked for a king and they had to paint them the way they wanted to be painted. Or it could be like Rothko, like ripping his skin off so that we get inside his body with him, you know. So there's not one kind of correct empathy or one kind of correct art. But it takes imagination and it takes time to get inside those things. And
I think you've said the word time and speed, and you've invoked like patience maybe about 8 times already.
Yeah.
And so my follow-up question was like, what makes art politically impactful in the era of Trump? And why is it not made with AI?
Yeah, AI is a shortcut. And I'm not going to bash AI for certain things that it can do, like accounting or find things, whatever. It has some uses, but to replace what humans do to express themselves is just, I don't understand that at all. Like, why would we want that? And I think that there's like a novelty to it. So some artists go to it and they're like, because what it takes a lot of work to make visible the invisible. And so the click of a button is really appealing. But the whole point of art, and I don't want to preach to artists, but I'm preaching to the people who are curious about art and don't really know what it takes. It's not like just I know what's in my head and I get it onto the paper or the canvas or the stone or whatever. It is process. It is the time of experimenting, trial and error. You learn through making. The British painter Bridget Riley talks about how she has an eye at the end of her pencil and that she doesn't know what she makes until she begins to make it.
Right.
And AI is that shortcut. And it's also stealing from other artists.
Right.
So it's just that shortcut, because people are under pressure sometimes, or they don't have that time to sit and experiment and make mistakes and go back and learn and keep playing with materials and that sort of thing. So yeah, that's why I think AI isn't a big problem right now.
Well, I think there's something too about the fact that you give it the prompt and because there is no I at the end of the pencil, and because you can't see how it's going through all of its stolen imagery to sort of create a composite of what it thinks you want, that your result is really just sort of outcome driven. It's like, did that work? And then if it didn't, you delete it. And then you might try the prompt again in a different way. And then you delete it if it doesn't work out. But I don't know that as you're interacting with that, you would be learning anything about process.
Exactly. You're not. And I think people are tricked into thinking that they, you know, again, it's, we're such an outcome oriented society, like just get there, just make this. And that is contrary to every work of art ever made, including music, including books, including films. And that removes the human element of it. It's not simply that it's just generating through a machine, but it is also removing the human process and creativity of it. And that's why I find it really problematic, because it's just saying that art is an outcome or a product when it isn't. It's an exploration. And I often use this analogy with my students. It's like, when you read a novel, you don't read the first two lines and put it down and say, I got it. You read the whole thing. And it's no different than with a painting. You know, you got to spend time with it. And because the person took time with it, with an AI image, it's immediately understandable. And that removes empathy. It removes your critical thinking, and it removes the artist's critical thinking too. So it's just empty, in my opinion.
I had two very profound influences on my early writing as a creative writer. And one was sort of abstract and theoretical, and I'll get to them in a moment, but the person who was my personal mentor and high school teacher, and then he became my great friend, his name was Luciano. And I think the most important thing that he, or perhaps anybody ever said to me ever, was, you know, whatever you do as you write, make sure that you surprise yourself. Like if you are not surprised by reading over the sentence that you just wrote, then you've probably become some kind of a parody of yourself. You've probably become some kind of parrot of, you know, what you think you want to do. And I thought that was an incredible thing. Like this, it still haunts my mind, actually, even in journalism, actually, you know, because, you know, if I apply the same principle to, I don't know where this story is going, then I think it's probably going to go somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. It's that, I go back to Bridget Riley, because, you know, she says it's called on not knowing.
Yeah.
It's like, if you know the outcome already, why are you doing it? You know, like you've got to take the time. And yeah, there's moments of surprise. And it's not about, you can't make art about other people. You can't make art to cater to other people. Even, as I said, these artists of the past who are like catering to a king, they have to have some sort of novelty and surprise in their works of art to make them compelling for themselves to keep working on. And when you just get like, okay, I want a picture of the Mona Lisa who, you know, and Beyonce, and then you just put it in there.
Do you think, just one more question about AI, and then I want to get to the history that you've done on art and fascism, but there is this principle that people have recognized when they're trying to figure out, like, why does this feel so weird to look at? And I think it's called the uncanny valley, where something is approaching realism and it doesn't quite get there, or it gets there and then it pulls back a little bit. It sort of looks like it could be real. And we all have this instinctive knowledge that it's like, most people can identify, in my experience, that, oh, that there's something off about that. Now, I think in a former time, there would have been a value in somebody being able to create that experience with their own artistry. Mm-hmm. And I think there are periods of art in which that sort of uncanny quality is probably a value. So what's the difference between the person, the artist who's doing that purposefully, and the bot that's doing that by mistake?
Well, it'd have to do with, I'd say, the art movement and the intentions of the art movement. the bot doing it by mistake, I think, is pulling upon things that we feel we know. We see thousands of images a day.
Yeah.
And so it's accidental. And we're like, I feel I've seen that, because you have.
Yeah.
In some way. Our brains are just like these vast spaces of recognition. And whereas an artist, say like the Surrealists, or I'm thinking also too of a Renaissance artist named Hans Holbein, who intentionally made strange things.
Right.
That's for making the audience look longer.
Huh. Okay.
Rather than kind of, and to have conversation, like, what is that? Why are we doing that? And this is more like, unintentional accident.
That's fascinating. I didn't know. So that's Holbein's thing is like, oh, if I make this weird, you're going to stay longer.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
That's
right.
How we get people's attention. Yes. A lot of artists do that. That's what Velázquez did.
Right.
Velázquez did that all the time, which is why he was called like the great theologist of painting, because he got people to look longer.
Is that the part of the idea or the technique of the trompe l'oeil as well?
Yeah. To look longer, to be really compelled to say, wow, look at that. And it's sometimes in our contemporary world, we're kind of always trying to equate how much it looks like reality.
Right.
And that's kind of the way that people thought then, but it's more this kind of marveling at how, what it feels like to look at something that isn't real. So it's slightly different experience, and to be compelled by that.
And I suppose there are very different ways of doing that, because like I've been in the Rothko room in London, for example, and I have sat there and not been able to leave, because I don't know what I'm looking at, and I'm going to sit there and kind of feel like I'm on a psychedelic trip, and you know, it takes a long time before I can gear up to leave. But then I can also do the same with the graphic design of M.C. Escher, and because I can't figure that out either. So I guess there's just a whole range of tricks, right?
There is. And I explain it in this way to students that I have, and I have so many students over the past 20 years, is art is about disorientation. And that's how the artist is going to get you to look longer.
Right.
And that's exactly why abstract art like Rothko is completely abstract, because you have to, it's not spoon feeding you narrative.
Right.
And so the artist wants you to spend more time thinking about why you're disoriented. And that becomes an individual experience rather than some sort of, you know, boilerplate, this is what this artwork is about. And that's why I think people are uncomfortable with that kind of art, because it's like, it takes time, going back to time again.
Okay. So let's backing up into your field to get very specific. Can you tell us a little bit about the key shift in fairly recent art history from optical replication to modern abstract or symbolic forms, and what that meant politically? Because a huge part of that shift, as I understand it, came out of the First World War, at least if we're talking about Europe, right?
Yeah. And I think if we're getting into fascism, we talk about European art, because the Europeans are sort of the origin
the fascist,
of fascism. So that's what we're going to do. It's to make a very small timeline, short timeline, is that we have the Industrial Revolution in the end of the 18th and early 19th century, which gets rid of artisans. You know, the people who made ceramic salt shakers and all those things, those things go away. So there's a little
carved tables, carved chairs. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Okay. Exactly. And, you know, my students, I'll take them to a museum. They'll say, oh, how could anyone afford this? I'm like, well, they have no choice, because that's all there was. They couldn't go to IKEA and buy something.
Right.
So yeah, there's that transforms art completely. And then you have about 80 years later, end of the 19th century, you have the development of optics, or the keener study of optics and perception and psychology.
Right.
And this pushes artists into going like, what am I actually seeing? Like, what is sight? What is knowledge? But the watershed moment is World War I. When artists see the slaughter and the devastation, so many of them in Europe are in the war, or have to evade the war, or lose someone in the war. They see art as a tool of power, associated with institutions of power, the church and state. And so they want to make art that is not useful for those institutions. And that means they turn away from the techniques that are used by kings and church, which is narrative, which is optical reality to have propaganda. So they begin to use things that are not associated with art, like garbage, toilets, their own bodies, poetry, readings, performances. And they do a lot of experimentation without a planned outcome, because art becomes more about the experience of making it than the outcome. And in this way, we also start to develop art therapy so that people can work out their trauma through making. So that's that watershed moment and one of the key reasons why artists are like no more of optical reality. And then we can get into what is kind of, it's a little bit cliche, and I think it's really quite too cursory of a summary, but why would you want to depict a world that looked like the horrors of that time? Some artists do, though, and they do it really well. So I think that that might be the reason for some artists, but I think by and large, it's art is a tool of these institutional power systems. And so they want to do what is not useful for them.
You know, it makes me think of the three downward arrows of the old anarchist and anti-fascist flag, where, you know, one downward arrow is down with fascism, one is down with monarchism, one is down with the church. There are variations on that, of course, but it sounds like there was a very specific kind of rationale that we have been doing this in service of power, and we're not going to do that anymore. Was that explicit, or did people just feel their way into that way of doing art as they recovered from their various traumas?
This is why we have our isms. The isms clearly tell us in their manifestos that it is explicit.
Okay.
So it depends on, there are certain artists working independently outside of the isms, but the big isms of this time period are Dadaism and Surrealism, it was an offshoot of Dadaism, but you could also include in Germany what is called Neue Sachlichkeit or New Objectivity, which didn't have a set manifesto per se, but it was about reflecting the world through a new kind of objectivity, which is very biased and subjective, and it's very confusing.
Yes, the new objectivity, not like the old objectivity, mm-hmm. but actually quite subjective.
It is, right? Exactly. It's okay. Again, the artist is witness. Like, my witness is truth. It doesn't matter what it looks like. This is what I've experienced. So it's objective.
Right.
And that's what the movement is about. And it's a massive collective movement in the middle of the 1920s in Germany. And these are all happening at the same time. Well, Dadaism kind of dries up by 1922, but Surrealism and New Objectivity are these two key movements on the continent that are explicit that we are doing this for this purpose of dismantling institutional power.
I'm not so familiar with the history of why Dadaism would dry up, but my understanding of that movement is that a primary focus was not just about withdrawing attention or service from, you know, institutions, but also questioning like the basic foundations of how language works, or whether or not philosophy is real, or whether or not we actually understand each other when we're speaking to each other at all. And didn't the war just tell us that maybe there is no such thing as a shared sort of human communication system? Is that fair?
Yes, it is. Because the leader of the movement was a poet. Or one of the key leaders of the movement was a poet. And so we have this interest in that words don't mean, the meaning that we assign to words is arbitrary.
Right.
Communication breakdown is definitely a part of that movement. It's when we talk about art, it's all art.
Right.
It's dance, it's theater, it's writing, it's poetry, it's everything. They really wanted to attack all, because all of those things were used by power systems.
To encourage people to go to war.
Exactly. To war, or just to kind of like say, this is the glory of our culture. Yeah, to encourage. I don't know if they were encouraged or forced. And then,
well, yeah.
Some of them were encouraged, others were forced, yeah.
The poet you're referencing, are you talking about Kurt Schwitters?
I'm talking about Tristan Tzara, but Kurt Schwitters is another poet of the movement. So what happens with Dada is founded in Zurich, Switzerland in 1915, and then it migrates to Berlin in 1918,
right.
And then into Kurt Schwitters is in Hanover. And then it dries up about 1922 because of infighting, and it feels too...
Because they don't have a shared language,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, exactly. They don't. Dada's so fragmented. Yeah. And so, and it's
right.
It's also really destructive. Like there is, the goal is to destroy everything.
Right.
And so the movements of the 1920s are constructive, but a constructive of a new world or a world they want to see.
But also a world that the emerging fascism in that time begins to label as degenerate. So... You know, is the new objectivity, for example, in Germany, does that become a target of what Hitler goes on to call degenerate art? And of course, his entire cohort, he gave a whole speech about it, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was his main target, were the degenerate artists. And it's one of the most important exhibitions in the history of art. The Degenerate Art Exhibition was coupled with the Great German Art Show. Sound familiar?
They were side by
yes,
side,
they were
like
side
in two different pavilions?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
More visitors to the Degenerate Show. And
right.
On the night of the...
Because it was more interesting.
It was more interesting. It was it was like, it's still one of the most visited exhibitions of the 20th century. And it toured the country too.
Right.
Yeah, the Degenerate Art Show, Hitler gave a speech. I highly recommend reading it because you see echoes of it when we talk about art today. One of the things is like Hitler says these kind of disingenuous cliques, he calls them, who make art for themselves and not for the people. I think that really sticks with a lot of modern and contemporary artists. They're disingenuous, that they're kind of like laughing at you. Because real art looks like this. Degenerate is like this degeneration of society, and particularly the Neue Sachlichkeit or the new objectivity artists. And the one they hated the most was Otto Dix and George Grosz.
What was wrong with them in particular?
They were both soldiers in World War I, and they
right.
hated what Germany did to its own people.
Right.
Otto Dix was also... very interested in dismantling traditions of sexuality, what women were supposed to look like.
Right.
He held nothing back from portraying soldiers that were disabled
right.
from war, undervalued. And so he made these grand paintings about that. And one of them was so popular that it toured the country in 1926, and it was immediately purchased by the Dresden Museum of Art. It's gone now. The Nazis burned it.
Wow.
Because it showed disabled soldiers, it showed the war itself. So the people really valued it, but the Nazis saw it as a degeneration of German culture.
So that's the show, folks, for today in part two, which is now up on Patreon. Sarah and I continue our discussion of fascist and anti-fascist art, and she ends with her sort of guidelines for her students with regard to finding their own aesthetic freedom. And then I follow up on that with a little bit of a coda on the things that I've learned over the last 35 years of being a writer that I think might be... maybe a little bit helpful for some people. So we'll see you there, or we'll see you back here on the main feed next week. Take care of each other.